Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of October 2nd, 2017. Current federal tax developments is brought to you by the Lascauzo Institute, a Kaplan company, and your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at the newly published framework for tax reform, trying to figure out how it may impact your clients and what may really happen when we take a look at this at the end of all the process that would result in a bill, assuming we get a bill. We're going to take a look at a few things, as I said, related to that particular proposal. Now, coming up, I want to remind you, those of you who are nearby, again, it's the time of the year when most of you have your heads down and you're doing your final tax returns. That'll be your October 15th returns. But if you have time, and if you're somewhere near or can get to Rapid City, South Dakota, this week, Don Cochran will be putting on a pair of courses, again, for the South Dakota Society of CPAs. On October 4th, he'll be doing a course on assisting the survivors of the decedent's estate. And then on October 5th, he'll be doing a course on the multi-state taxation of business, an interesting course in South Dakota because South Dakota is ground zero for one of the most significant challenges to the Quill case that we discussed a couple of weeks ago. If you want to sign up for that course, you're listening to this before Wednesday, and you can get to South Dakota by Wednesday or Thursday, depending upon which of the two courses you want to take. You can register at the South Dakota Society's website at www.sdcpa.org. Well, this week we had, as I mentioned, the wonderful new tax reform framework issued. As I was preparing to get things ready for this week, I had developments ready to go. But then I took a look at the framework and decided that it really didn't make sense to give it like 30 seconds worth of coverage and then kind of skip by and do something else. But that if I actually did anything that looked at it very deep, we'd have no real time for those other developments. So what I've decided to do is hold those developments and then next week cover those along with whatever else may come up. And this week devote ourselves to looking at the framework. The framework was issued under the title Unified Framework for Fixing Our Broken Tax Code. Now, you can find it at the House Ways and Means Committee website. The link is on the Current Federal Tax Developments website, and the link is available if you download the PDF that we'll push onto the website, so you can take a look at that and find it. It has the information. It is a 9-page framework, but really only 6 pages have descriptions of the provisions. It's got a cover sheet that mainly tells you the title. Okay, that doesn't help us learn a whole lot. It has 2 pages of justifying, you know, and telling us what this will do, which pretty standard language that we always see for most tax bills. As I've said tongue-in-cheek multiple times, I've yet to see a tax bill that doesn't create jobs. You know, you can just basically take that paragraph and keep putting it in each time. So we have that background. Whether or not it does, it depends on the actual details, and that's something that comes later. Then finally, we get to 6 pages. Those 6 pages tell us about some broad outlines of what they're going to do. Now, it's important to recognize that those 6 pages are missing a lot of details. That is, there are a lot of issues that even the framework, when it mentions some of these things, only tells us that they're going to work on it, but doesn't really tell us what they're going to do. To give you a way of comparison, if you go back to the 1986 Tax Act, when the Treasury Department, which was who initiated this, so in 1986, it was initiated by the administration, the Reagan administration, and we had the Treasury Department came out with their report and their proposed revision of the code, which was actually draft law, which this is not, and it was over 400 pages that had, you know, incredible details about what they were going to do. Now, it turns out that that wasn't what they actually did in many areas. We had lots of changes to that, but you had a lot of meat to work with. This case, we don't have that level of details. We have some key issues and maybe some key items mentioned. Not surprisingly, the things that people will generally like are what there's agreement on. And what there's not a lot of details on is what are those things we're going to give up to get those things we might like. That's where we have fewer levels of agreement. And that's honestly where the problem's going to come. We're still, as one article in Tax Analyst said back early in the year, we got the 1-page summary, it's still the problem that the devil is in the lack of details. So a lot of what's going to happen here, we're not going to know for quite a while. That brings one other point I want to say. I really have trouble right now with anybody telling me that they're all for this or they're all against this, because right now we have no idea what this really is. And, you know, what's really kind of interesting is you see articles that tell you what this will do, and I keep looking at the six pages, and I haven't yet figured out how they know it will be a windfall for the rich, or it will be a middle class break, or it will be whatever it is. If you look at this, you go, well, there's just not enough there to make the call. And that's going to be true for your clients as well. We can talk in broad strokes and certainly have some ideas about things that might happen. And it could suggest some steps that maybe, you know, you might want to delay doing some things or accelerate some things because of what may or may not happen in the future based on this, but some ideas of what might be coming. But as far as being able to tell a client whether or not if this bill passes, their tax bill will go up or down, we're not near that at this point yet. So be aware of that and be careful. Let's go ahead then and move on and start talking about some of the detailed items in here. The first item they discuss in the framework relates to the standard deduction. Now, I say standard deduction and personal exemptions because those two are tied. They even discuss personal exemptions under standard deduction. But for various reasons, including the fact that, you know, they're trying to get people to sign on to this, they chose to emphasize in the header the standard deduction and then quietly bring in the issue with personal exemptions because that issue doesn't work quite as well in selling the bill. But the good news, let's start with, and it is good news, the standard deduction is nearly doubled under this proposal. The standard deduction for a single taxpayer would go to $12,000 from what will be for 2017, $6,350. And for a married couple filing a joint return, it'll go to $24,000 from the current $12,700. There are a couple of details missing here. We have no discussion of the head of household filing status. And that's interesting because in some previous versions of this bill, head of household appears to have disappeared. We don't know if the implication here is that head of household will not be in the final bill, or more likely, they haven't decided yet if it will be in the final bill. But we have to, you know, kind of hold that in abeyance. Also, there's no discussion about whether the additional standard deduction that was given for individuals over 65 or who are blind, if that will also remain in the law, or if that will go away, at, you know, when you make the change to this level. But another issue, near doubling sounds good, and it sounds like, you know, a lot fewer people would have to file tax returns because we would have, you know, they would essentially have a huge area where you wouldn't need to file because it'd be doubling up the standard deduction. But turns out it's not quite as good as that. In addition, they would get rid of personal exemptions. Actually, they're going to get rid of exemptions in total. You know, we'll talk about that here for a second, but they'll get rid of that entirely. But getting rid of the personal exemptions, and remember, the personal exemptions this year are scheduled to be for 2017, $4,050. That means for a single taxpayer, that one now gets a $12,000 standard deduction, they lose $4,050 personal exemption. So that means in 2017, before this law, they could have up to $10,400 of taxable income before the exemptions and for the exemptions and the standard deduction and not pay tax. That goes up, but only to $12,000. For a married couple, they would get two personal exemptions. That'd be $8,100. If you add that to the $12,700, that gets you $20,800. So now we're moving that zero tax area from $20,800 to $24,000. Again, it goes up, but it doesn't nearly double. You know, it gets to be a much more modest increase. In fact, it basically raises, in both cases, the zero tax bracket by about 15%. So there will be fewer people that need to file a return, but it's not as if we're getting rid of wide swaths of the population by doubling the size of level where you'd need to file a return. Now, the other thing that happens is other exemptions, and they're also hit by this. You would not get exemptions any longer for having children, nor would you get exemptions for any other dependents. Rather, for the children, we're going to get an increased child tax credit. Now, it'll still be up to $1,000 of it will still be refundable. That's the good news. The bad news is we don't know how much it's increasing. And for other dependents, you would get a $500 exemption rather than the $4,500 exemption you get currently. So the $500 exemption would be better than the value of that exemption if you were in the 10% bracket today, but worse if you're in the other bracket. So, you know, it's one of those trade-offs we're going to take a look at there. So again, that's one to keep. The size of the child tax credit will be important for people that have, you know, a number of children as dependents. The program also talks about the individual tax brackets. And under this, the framework tells us we're going to go from 7 brackets to 3, but there's an asterisk on the 3. So let's say really 3 or maybe 4 is really what it says at the end when you finally get done with it. Currently, our rates are 10%, 15, 25, 28, 33, 35, and 39.6. We'll take those 7 brackets and drop them into brackets of 12%, 25%, 35%, and the asterisk. Okay, what's the asterisk? And, you know, what's this maybe fourth bracket? Well, the maybe fourth bracket, and according to reports we've seen, this was insisted upon by the administration. If that last bracket that will be higher will be added if it is needed to make the final tax reform be at least as progressive as current law. The president ran on a platform of saying he's going to have a middle tax class tax cut and that the wealthy would not be the prime beneficiaries of his tax cut. Well, in order to maintain that position, the administration is insisting that a fourth bracket may have to go on top of here. So what that fundamentally means is don't write off the 39.6 bracket just yet. It may very well stay around, especially as they're trying to find ways to pay for other benefits they want to offer. So we may see the 39.6, and in fact, the proposal doesn't really tell us it wouldn't go above 39.6. I think that'd be a difficult sell for the Congress. But again, the framework simply says they could be a higher bracket. Finally, we're going to revise the inflation adjustment calculation. We don't have much on that, but it would be a more accurate measure of inflation. In essence, we wouldn't use the CPI as currently calculated. There'd be some other way of handling the inflation calculation. Next up, Congress looks at the AMT and, like most of us, decides that they don't like it. So they would repeal both the individual and the corporate AMT. This is, I think, for most of us, great news because that's always been a painful thing. And clearly, at this point in time, it doesn't work the way it was designed back years ago when it was first brought up. But the real problem is, while we're all hoping for this, it's also a very costly item to put on there, and they're going to need money. That's going to be a fundamental issue we're going to have coming forward on this. So unfortunately, this may be a break that's more at risk if they start putting other breaks back in the law, as they're going to get pressured to do. So I'll cross my fingers, but I have to worry that the AMT is a place they could quietly sneak something back in the law and be able to raise a lot of money without necessarily making it look like they'd given up on a whole bunch of other issues. Next up in the framework, itemized deductions. Most itemized deductions would no longer exist. And the term in the framework is most. That's not me simplifying it for you. That's how they word it. So what that really means is that we're not going to have a list of what's really gone yet. We do have 2 itemized deductions, though, that are off limits. They will not be getting stricken by this law. The first one, which was some concern, was the mortgage interest deduction. And more importantly, nothing in here suggests that they are going to reduce the home mortgage interest deduction. There had been a lot of speculation during the process. And in fact, there had been a number of leaks. And leaks are always interesting, because you always have to worry about the party leaking and why they want it leaked. But in many cases, you know, especially in a case like this, you oftentimes have what are kind of strategic leaks, where they leak something just to see how much pushback they would get. And especially in a thing like this, it's useful to do that because you can always say, oh, that's a leak, we never confirmed it, but you get the feel for how things are going to go. There were a number of leaks that suggested they might have the home mortgage interest deduction, or have the amount of interest, you know, the amount of mortgage you could use. So instead of $1 million of mortgage, for acquisition debt, we'd be cut back to 500,000. Nothing suggested in this now that they're going down that route. My guess is they floated the trial balloon and discovered that the real estate lobby came back hard. So essentially, we're just going to leave that where it is, probably. And we're also going to get charitable contributions. That one, almost everybody had assumed from day one, there was no way they were going to touch that one. So that one seems fine. It's off limits. However, that leaves everything else on Schedule A potentially on the table. That means things like state and local taxes. That's both state and local income taxes and sales taxes, but also real estate taxes on those homes. The real estate lobby is not going to like that one. And as the statements have been made that they're already gearing up to lobby Congress to get the real estate deduction for the principal residence put back on Schedule A. We also are likely, under that, we have at risk any deductions for things like gambling losses. We have at-risk deductions for your tax return preparation, tax planning, investment advisory fees, medical expenses. All of those are, we don't know, which of those constitute most. Which one of those will be in the most list, and will any of those survive and be added to our two off-limit deductions? We're not sure at the moment. Now, also on that list is an itemized deduction that could be struck or casualty and theft losses. However, recent events have made it much more politically difficult to remove that now. The hurricanes that have hit Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, the American Virgin Islands, those hurricanes and the damage they've done, Congress is already moving bills to allow for, simpler expense, for simpler casualty and theft loss deductions, getting rid of the 10% floor, getting rid of the $100 floor for people in those affected areas. Can they really turn around and then next year say, if you get hit by a hurricane 2018, tough luck? You won't be able to deduct it. Hurricanes, tornadoes, all those things no longer will be deductible items. That might be a tough sell today. I wouldn't be shocked to see casualty and theft losses remain available on Schedule A for personal casualty and theft losses. Just guessing at this point. Now, if this process were to drag on for a while, and we got far enough away from the hurricanes, then very well casualty and theft losses might disappear. A year ago, it would have probably been a lot easier to have, in fact, it probably been a second thought given to chopping casualty and theft losses off the list at the same time. Now, a little more difficult. Next group up is a really vague set of statements on work, education, and retirement. And what they do is they make a very vague statement that they want to simplify this. In fact, what they say is the framework retains tax benefits that encourage work, higher education, and retirement security. Okay. Now, it doesn't say retain all, so we have to kind of watch that. The committees are encouraged to simplify these benefits to improve their efficiency and effectiveness. Tax reform will seek to maintain or raise retirement plan participation of workers and the resources available for retirement. When you finally parse that paragraph, you didn't learn a whole lot as to what exactly is going to happen, except there are going to be some changes, but they're apparently not going to get rid of these things. We don't really define what those benefits that encourage work, higher education, retirement security are. You could probably read into that. Maybe the earned income credit encourages work. Higher education is encouraged by the various education credits, and retirement security. Obviously, the deductions are certain items for retirements. One proposal that had been floated was to get rid of the deduction for 401k plan contributions and force all 401k plan contributions to be Roth. That still could fit under this line, but seems less likely. In essence, my guess is there probably means that we may have at least given up or significantly reduce the concept of trying to use the Rothification structure here to change retirement plans to Roths. And by the way, one of the key reasons why Congress would like to do that is to get their hands on the money up front. That would be involved with reducing the tax deduction from the 401k. Again, we need some funds here. Okay. Now, the other thing they tell us, they plan to repeal most of the other basically exemptions, deductions, and credits for individuals that riddle the tax code. Again, not sure what that means. It doesn't have the lines about most, so it's not as if they're, it's not as if we're going to have this supposed mass cleaning where everything goes away. Many, probably the way you read political statements, many could be simply anything more than one. If they can point to two, then they actually, you know, repealed many provisions. Yes, that's it. It's got to be more than one, but, you know, two, three, four, then suddenly I have no idea when we get to many. But this area is obviously very open. Now, what does this what do these paragraphs really mean? It probably means that right now they don't have consensus on how to move in a lot of those areas. So they've left it open to the committees. This is a to-be-determined item. Next up, we're going to, remember, didn't we repeal the estate tax once? Yeah, but then it came back. Well, now we're going to go do it again. We're going to repeal the estate and the generation-skipping transfer tax. This is not as big a deal as it was under AGTRA back in 2001, simply because the exemption now being at $5,500,000, that gets rid of the vast majority of people who are having to file estate tax returns when the exemption was only $1,000,000. But nevertheless, it still has impact on those people who have estates over $5.5 million and actually with portability over $11 million. So we have an issue there. It would be kind of nice to get rid of, obviously. We should also note that nowhere does it say the gift tax would go away. And that probably is intentional. Under AGTRA, the gift tax was left in place. And the justification for that, even with the estate tax repeal, was that it was felt that if they did not have a gift tax, taxpayers would game the system by giving, quote unquote, assets to lower income relatives. And then after the assets were sold, those lower income relatives would generously give back the assets to the original donor, that you could structure deals like that where there would be a gift where everybody knew it was going to be gifted back later. And the idea was that that would set up a lot of cheating that would be difficult for the IRS to come up with some enforcement against. So because of that, we're going to retain the gift tax. So the gift tax remains. So what the impact there would obviously be that now you don't make lifetime gifts for the most part. You hold until you die because you want it to pass through your estate when there's no transfer tax that would be involved. How about business tax rates? Corporate rates would be capped at 20%. That's for C corporations. One issue here, they don't mention what would happen to personal service corporations. And that's kind of a big what would happen, especially for those of us in professional entities wanting to know, do we go back and resurrect the C corps for the accounting firms and the law firms? My guess will be the answer is no, but it may be possible. We'll see. Pass-through business from small and family-owned businesses would be capped at 25%. Okay, that sounds good, except now we get into a bunch of problems. They tell us they would add anti-abuse provisions to stop conversions of higher tax income to lower tax by wealthy individuals. Now, remember, higher tax income under this proposal would include wages that are paid for services. So the question quickly becomes, will we have a problem here that you can only get the 25% rate for the income from your closely held business that doesn't represent compensation for services, which would theoretically be subject to at least up to a 35% rate, potentially to a higher rate? Or is that going to be part of the 25? If it's part of the 25, then obviously operating as self-employed would be much better for most people than operating as not self-employed, at least, you know, except for the self-employment tax side of it. You'd have to work that little detail out. But obviously, you know, there's a big difference there between 25% and 20, certainly for closely held businesses. Why would you want to take a salary and, you know, have to end up paying the FICA and everything if the flow through income is going to be at 25? So yeah, that could be interesting. The details there, two big details to watch for. Number one, what are the special rules for things like personal service corporations? Number two, what's the definition of a small and family-owned business? Because it doesn't say all pass-throughs get this rate. Only small and family-owned businesses do. And finally, what exactly are the anti-abuse provisions going to be and how do they get implemented? Expect to have a lot of really messy rules to play with, my guess be at the end, and all kinds of work to be done in order to figure out how to make this fit within this special business tax rate rules, especially for the pass-through entities. Hey, for buying equipment, we got some new things there. There'll be an immediate write-off of new equipment other than structures that are acquired after September 27th, 2017. That's when this was issued. Interestingly enough, that is the only effective date you're going to find in this document. And that's important because there have been discussions about having these rules apply for 2017 as a whole. This type of provision would work with that. It'd say, well, if you bought something before September, obviously you didn't buy it because you knew about this expensing rule. So, you know, we're only going to let you do that for things you bought after that date. We want to encourage expensing. But other parts of this will be very difficult to throw back to the beginning of 17. And you also have the basic problem of, can they possibly get this thing passed? But that does raise an interesting problem if they keep this date in here. Will there be a retroactive provision for 17 that will deal with expensing of assets, even if all the rest of these items are delayed effective dates until 18 or later? Not sure, but the fact they mentioned this date raises the interesting question about a potential change in how it goes. Now, big thing to note there, they don't necessarily, and I'm paraphrasing a bit when I say new equipment, but it certainly implies it's new equipment, which means what we're looking at here is effectively 100% bonus depreciation like we had for a short time before. The catch is used equipment won't count. Now, this raises a key issue. Small entities who purchase less than $500,000 worth of equipment already can write off all their equipment, and they can write it off whether it's new or used. So if 179 were to be repealed, and you can certainly see Congress saying there's no need for 179 with this in place, some small businesses could be worse off because some of the used equipment they currently buy and expense could suddenly have to be capitalized and depreciated. The other hitch with this one is this explicitly has a sunset attached to it. Now, we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but this one says they guarantee it'll exist for at least 5 years. Now, it's interesting they guarantee it for 5 years. That suggests, well, maybe some of the other stuff we're talking about isn't guaranteed for any period of time. You know, it could only be for a single year. And the flip side of that is it also suggests that this probably won't go beyond 5 years because they can do 5 years, they met their promise, and then they can use the money elsewhere. So, yeah, you know, this is kind of interesting, and this is probably not the only sunset we will see. So just be aware of that. Interest expense. This was originally the trade-off for me to expensing was that net interest deduction would be totally disallowed for businesses. Now we're going to change that a bit. Deduction of net interest expense, which is your interest expense in excess of your interest income, would be partially limited for C corporations. We have no idea what the partial limitation would be as opposed to full limitation, but presumably we'd get to deduct some of it in some cases. Would that be dependent on the size of the business? Would it be dependent on the amount? Would we get a certain percentage above? We don't know. But we do know that there'd be some reduction in interest deductions for C corporations. They also say they're going to consider the proper treatment for non-corporate borrowers' interest. Obviously, that means on pass-throughs and on Schedule Cs, you know, and consider the proper treatment. Today, we get a write-off entirely. So the only change you could look at would be to lose part of the deduction, it would seem. In any event, that's still open. So they back some off saying you're just going to lose the deduction for interest. But they are certainly suggesting that business interest may very well be deducted and not totally deductible in the future. And potentially that will be for everybody. You know, keep your eye on it. Other business deductions and credits, they talk about those. On the credits, two credits would be preserved without question. And there are two credits that have large lobbying groups behind them. The research and development credit would be preserved. Okay, the R&D credit, and that used to drive the extenders every time, got lots of contributions to congressmen to run for re-election. So the R&D credit definitely stays around, as does the low-income housing credit. Other credits, they expect to remove most other credits, though if there's budget room available and they serve a good purpose, and anybody know of a credit we enacted that didn't claim to serve a good purpose, then we would maybe keep some of the others around. So that's kind of interesting. In essence, we're up for bids here. They would also eliminate the Section 199 deduction and most other special benefits and deductions in the code. So the 199 domestic production activities deduction, that would be gone under this law. Their final thing they took a look at was change in worldwide taxation issues. There would be an immediate repatriation of all offshore earnings of U.S. corporations. Now, it sounds bad right away, right? Well, yeah, that would be bad. They'd probably consider it, except there are a few things to ease the pain, actually a number of things. First, the tax in question would be spread over a number of years. So there'd be immediate repatriation, but to be given a number of years to pay the tax. Number two, they would be given, to the extent that their assets overseas are invested in illiquid assets like property, plant, equipment, that sort of thing, as opposed to cash and securities, they would be able to take a lower rate to the extent they could show that those earnings were invested in illiquid assets. Now, the trade-off is that after that happens, we would lose that whole repatriation issue entirely, and we would go to a different system. There'd be 100% exclusion for foreign entity dividends as long as the company owned at least 10% of the foreign corporation. And the U.S. would begin taxing foreign earnings of multinational corporations. It would be at a lower rate than the U.S., and they claim they're going to put in rules so that U.S. headquartered companies aren't put at a disadvantage versus overseas headquartered companies. Effectively, we know just enough about the vague outline there to realize this is going to be complicated and messy, but also one you want to keep your eye on as we move forward. Okay, so let's talk about the prospects for the proposal. First thing is, this is going to be moved via the reconciliation mechanism. Remember, that's the thing that failed to produce repeal and replace. We're going to do it the same way. So the catch is, it's got different things. Reconciliation is useful because the advantage is you can pass it with a mere majority in the Senate. And, you know, that means that the party that controls the Senate can effectively pass their own bill with no support from the other party. That is not true for most bills in the Senate that don't part of reconciliation. They generally need 60 votes to agree to vote on the bill. Well, obviously, if the Democrats were to withhold their votes and vote no on voting, vote no on allowing a vote, which these days the minority party almost always will exercise that option, then you're going to need to persuade at least, you know, 8 Democrats to, at a minimum, allow the vote. Or more likely, they need to vote for it, because if they allow the vote, they're going to be treated as if they voted for it when they go to run for re-election in their primaries. So you need to persuade them that they actually want to vote for the bill. That's difficult these days in a highly partisan atmosphere, because you'll be, as they call it these days, primaried. So that's a problem. So good news is we can pass it with just the majority party. No need to worry about getting the minority party support. But there are bad news issues to it. First, and this did not affect healthcare, but it majorly affects tax reform, there is a 10-year cliff provision. What we mean by that, under the rules for a reconciliation bill, it cannot commit the government to actions that would increase the deficit after, you know, more than 10 years out. So it has to be revenue neutral from year 11 to infinity. We have to have revenue neutral from year 11 on. It can't negatively affect the tax bill. As you may remember, AGTRA came in under this proposal. It could not get the 60 votes to go outside of reconciliation. So because of that, that's why we had the fiscal cliff. And that's why the estate tax, you know, was repealed and then immediately reappeared, because they didn't have the votes to make the repeal permanent, because they needed 60 for that. And so that means that a lot of these things we're talking about could disappear at the end of 10 years, or at least on paper be ready. And everybody remember how much fun estate planning was for the 10 years while AGTRA was around, when we didn't know what was going to happen at the end of the 10 years. The same problem would occur now. The other problem is the need for virtually unanimous Republican backing of this bill. That's going to be especially a problem in the Senate. As we discovered with the healthcare bill, there can only be 2 Republican defections. before they've got to find either Democrat votes to back them up, which means compromising probably some Democrats to add some things they want, or they have to let another major legislative initiative fall by the wayside because they couldn't get it through. So again, this is complicated. And why it's complicated, initially it looks like tax reform, this should be an easy sell for a Republican majority. But the problem is there are a lot of interests that have a lot of provisions that they want to see kept in the bill, and they are going to make some real hefty threats, shall we say, at people who don't back them up. So you may find that a lot of these senators will be pressured to not give up a break that's especially important back home. And that means, you know, and therefore they're going to insist on that being in there. As soon as you start doing that, this bill starts looking less like reform and more like, and nothing really big. There's a reasonable chance because of that, and some people still believe this is the most likely scenario, that what we'll actually get is simply a straight up tax cut. And all of these provisions that talk about majorly changing how the law works will go by the wayside because we can't get the trade-offs to let us do the other things we'd want to do in this area. So we might just cut rates by a couple percentage points, go home and call that tax reform. We'll have to see. Well, as we remember, when you finish up with all those October 16th returns, remember to go check out your State Society of CPAs. Now is the time to get your education before the end of the year. Those courses are available, and you can find them listed there. I've got courses coming up in a number of states. Don's got courses. All of us out here with the LaScalzo Institute have courses coming up around the country. So check and see what's available. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October 2nd, 2017. You can catch our daily updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We'll post there if something happens, and I've got time to write it up. I'll write it up and post it there. You can also send questions or comments to me online. edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com is the email address to send them to for this program. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at edzollers. As I post things, I will give you a Twitter link to the post so you can follow me there. Well, hopefully you've given you something to think about this week. Next week, we will go back to our standard updates, and I'll talk about some of the things that I didn't have time to talk about this week. And we'll talk about whatever happens in the coming week here in the area of federal taxes.